there's the RCMP have been using exclusion zones, which is something that was also used on against Wet'suwet'en land defenders last year, and that's where they just block access on a logging road to sometimes, you know, hundreds of kilometers of further logging road and all the territory that's behind that. So people then need to hike around or face arrest for trying to walk through. There's been a lot of violence used against people that are defending, like that are non-violently attaching themselves to the road or to tripods with sleeping dragons. And
Noah, we're going to have to leave it there, but we will continue to cover this issue. Noah Ross, attorney for land defenders at Ferry Creek Blockade, and Katie George Jim, Indigenous land defender. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
When a cap or trees is birds for wings.
Tune in this Friday, September 17th from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for a special fall membership drive edition of the Cascadia Coffee House, where we celebrate the 111th Pendleton Roundup, happening this week with a morning of folk music from the American West. The Pendleton Roundup is a week-long celebration of Western heritage and community spirit that centers on one of the largest outdoor, non-commercial rodeos and is a treasured Oregon tradition. Again, that's this week's Cascadia Coffee House on Friday, September 17th, from 5:30 to 7 a.m., right here on KBOO. See you then, and let her buck.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. New modeling shows Oregon hospitals may be full with COVID-19 patients for another 6 weeks. Oregon's unemployment rate falls to 4.9%, signaling strong economic growth. And polls are open in California as voters decide whether they will keep or recall Governor Gavin Newsom. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 14th, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Voters across California are turning out Tuesday to determine the fate of Governor Gavin Newsom. Californians are deciding whether to remove the governor from office, and if so, who should replace him. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
California voters headed to the polls to decide whether or not to remove Governor Gavin Newsom from office. Californians have been frustrated with Newsom's response to the COVID pandemic, feeling he has been too restrictive. For example, California was one of the slowest states to get children back to school. Californians have also found his rules for businesses, including restaurants, to be inconsistent. The recall movement gained momentum in November when Newsom attended a birthday party at an upscale French restaurant. At the same time, he was urging California residents to stay home and avoid gatherings with multiple households. Newsom apologized, calling the dinner a, quote, bad mistake, end quote. Recall proponents had to gather almost 1.5 million valid signatures for the recall to qualify. They easily surpassed that figure. Newsom framed the potential recall as an effort led by Trump supporters and right-wing extremists to keep the California government from being too progressive. He previously called it a, quote, Republican recall of white supremacists, anti-Semites, and people who are opposed to immigration and immigrants, end quote. The ballot asked voters two questions. Should Gavin Newsom be recalled from the office of governor? And if he is recalled, who should succeed him? If a majority votes yes to the first question, his replacement comes from those named in the second question. That list includes candidates from all parties. In total, 46 contenders qualified for the ballot. The top candidate takes over the office without having to get the majority of the vote. The new governor would take the oath of office on the 38th day after the election and would serve out the remainder of Newsom's term through January 2, 2023. Only one California governor has been successfully recalled since the mechanism went into law in 1911. Gray Davis was removed in 2003 and replaced by Arnold Schwarzenegger. The cost of this recall election exceeds $275 million. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon reported 4,700 new cases of COVID-19 over the weekend, bringing the total number of cases reported in the state since the beginning of the pandemic up to 303,532. A total of 32 more deaths were reported, raising the state's death toll up to 3,446 people. More than 1,000 people are currently hospitalized statewide, including 274 patients in intensive care units. The state has just 10% of its adult ICU beds available and only 7% of its non-ICU beds. New modeling shows Oregon hospitals may be full with COVID-19 patients for another 6 weeks. Peter Graven, a data scientist at Oregon Health and Sciences University, has published his latest data modeling that shows the trend of the virus in the state. Graven estimates that about 26% of Oregonians are not vaccinated and have also not yet been infected by the COVID virus. Graven said those are the people the virus will try to reach. The modeling shows that once someone is infected, they pass the virus onto another 6 or 7 others on average. According to a new study, education, race, and political ideology are the major factors that determine COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy. The research examines how virus infections in social circles may influence vaccine willingness. Roz Brown has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A new study shows people who don't have a close friend or family member who've had a run-in with COVID-19 are more likely to express vaccine hesitancy than those who know someone who's gotten sick. Vaccine hesitancy and reasons for it were studied by a team of researchers that included Jagdish Khubchandani, a public health sciences professor at New Mexico State University. He says study participants were asked if someone in their social circle had been infected, hospitalized, or died due to COVID-19.
And those who said yes are more likely to accept a vaccine. So those who do not know anyone who has died in family or friends or hospitalized are 2 times more likely to deny a vaccine.
The study was published last week in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. It included 1,600 participants, with about 80% reporting that they'd received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. 10% of the remaining participants said they planned to get it, while 11% said they would not. Khubchandani says vaccine refusal in the study group was higher among non-Hispanic Black people, political conservatives, independent-leaning voters, suburban dwellers, people with less than a college education, and non-married individuals. He believes hesitancy has been caused in part due to inconsistent messaging from the federal government about vaccines and about wearing masks.
Vaccine hesitancy is a very complicated topic. I've always said global health crises are also information and communication crises. We have no strategies to deal with the issue.
The Biden administration has avoided vaccine mandates until last week, when it announced vaccinations or proof of weekly testing will be required for federal government employees, including those in the healthcare sector. I'm Roz Brown reporting.
According to data out Tuesday, Oregon's unemployment rate fell to 4.9% in August, a historically low level and the latest sign of the state's tightening labor market. The state's jobless rate has rarely been below 5% in the 45 years for which Oregon has comparable records. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, Oregon's unemployment rate jumped to 13.2% in April of 2020. The state has now recovered 72% of the jobs it lost to the pandemic. Oregon currently classifies 98,000 people as unemployed, down from 176,000 in August of 2020. As many as 80,000 unemployed Oregonians lost jobless benefits after Labor Day, the cutoff date for a number of federal aid programs. That means a loss of roughly $60 million a week in assistance to Oregon workers. Those who lost benefits include self-employed workers who do not pay into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund but received aid during the pandemic under temporary programs established by Congress. Last week's benefits expiration also hit workers who had been unemployed for an extended period but continued receiving aid through pandemic assistance programs. Economists believe the cutoff may push a small number of people back into the workforce, but believe it is unlikely to have a major impact. The number of Oregonians collecting jobless benefits has been in steep decline all year, even while expanded benefits were in place. New data released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture suggests that overall food insecurity remained steady in 2020 at just over 10%, but hunger rates for single moms and families of color were significantly higher in 2020 than in the previous year. Eric Galatis has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The rate of people experiencing hunger in Colorado and across the U.S. remained statistically steady overall during 2020, according to initial data released by the USDA, but people of color and low-income workers experienced food insecurity at dramatically higher rates during the pandemic. Jerry Henchy with the Food Research and Action Center says 40% of single-parent households headed by women did not know where their next meal was coming from.
You know, a lot of single moms were working at jobs that you couldn't do at home. They lost their jobs during COVID, and some of them can't find childcare so they can go back to work. And so all of this results in these households really struggling to put enough food on the table.
Government aid packages boosting SNAP and other programs passed with bipartisan support are credited for keeping overall hunger rates steady as the economy sheds some 20 million jobs. Critics of proposals making their way through Congress to permanently expand supports for struggling families argue that additional spending is not needed because overall rates remained at just over 10% of U.S. households. Henchy isn't sure the initial data tells the whole story, in part because getting people to respond to surveyors going door-to-door during a global pandemic was no easy feat. Even if overall hunger rates did remain steady, Henchy says the need continues to be significant.
There were already unacceptably high rates of food insecurity in the U.S., and those have continued, so that's 38 million hungry people and hungry households.
Communities of color were also disproportionately impacted in 2020. Black households experienced hunger at three times the rate of white households.
Basically, 22% of black families and 17% of Latinx households were impacted by food insecurity, and that's considerably higher than the rate of white households, which was only 7%.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
In 2020, wildfires in Oregon burned more than 1 million acres statewide. Wildfire victims have until tomorrow, Wednesday, September 15th, to opt in for a state-led cleanup program. The state of Oregon is working with federal, state, and local partners to clean up after the wildfires that devastated the region in the summer of 2020. The Oregon Departments of Transportation, Environmental Quality, and Emergency Management are leading the effort. The group is called the Oregon Wildfire Debris Management Task Force. The cleanup helps property owners who were affected by the wildfires with debris removal on their property. The state set the September 15th deadline for victims of the 2020 wildfires to sign up for the program. Cleanup crews hired by the state will remove hazard trees, ash, and debris from burned properties. This cleanup is available to all property owners that sign up. Homes, mobile home parks, businesses, second residences, and other properties are eligible. When finished, properties would be ready for rebuilding. Wildfire survivors who have not yet signed up for the cleanup program can call 503-934-1700 to enroll before the deadline or visit wildfire.oregon.gov/cleanup for more information. All of us are exposed to perfluorinated and polyfluorinated substances, also known as PFAS, but perhaps firefighters most of all. Legislation to tackle the issue is currently moving through Congress. PFAS are dubbed forever chemicals because they do not naturally break down. Roz Brown has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Lawmakers and regulators are increasingly mobilizing behind efforts to crack down on so-called forever chemicals, or PFAS, and firefighters are among the most vocal critics. Firefighters who are exposed to the compounds through both firefighting foam and turnout gear are demanding action from the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Congress. Scott Faber with the nonprofit Environmental Working Group says the accumulation of PFAS in the human body is known to wreak havoc.
These forever chemicals have been linked to very, very serious health problems, including cancer, harm to our reproductive systems, including harm to our immune systems at a time when all of us are thinking about our immune system.
As part of a budget reconciliation bill, Congress is considering an $80 million program that would help fire departments across the country replace firefighting foam and gear that contains PFAS chemicals. Those compounds were present in toxic dust created when the World Trade Center collapsed on 9/11, contributing to cases of cancer and respiratory disease. PFAS touch every corner of a firefighter's work environment, according to Edward Kelly, general president of the International Association of Firefighters. He says it's telling that nearly 70% of firefighter deaths this year will be attributed to occupational cancer.
The tools and the gear we use to keep ourselves safe are poisoning us, all of us. It's heartbreaking, it's unacceptable, and we have to stop it.
And PFAS are not just an issue for firefighters. Last week, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it was adding Texas's Northeast Odessa groundwater to the Superfund National Priorities List, an area known to be contaminated with lead and PFAS. A range of consumer products contain the toxic chemical, which means most Americans have it in their blood, according to the CDC. I'm Roz Brown reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, discussing September 11th, 20 years later. We turn our attention not to the tragedy of 9/11 itself, but to 9/11 as an inflection point in U.S. culture and policy in two areas: domestic surveillance in the form of fusion centers and the government and public regard of the use of torture in the war on terror. Then at 6, it's preference. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 63 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a high of 72 degrees. Today in history, in 1814, Francis Scott Key pens a poem which is later set to music, and in 1931 becomes the U.S. national anthem, The Star-Spangled Banner. The poem, originally titled The Defense of Fort McHenry, was written after Key witnessed the Maryland fort being bombarded by the British during the War of 1812. Key was inspired by the sight of a lone U.S. flag still flying over Fort McHenry at daybreak. The quote of the day is from American sociologist and civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois, who said, quote, "The cost of liberty is less than the price of repression." A House hearing on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan turns contentious. Democrats plan to tax the rich to pay for a $3.5 trillion budget plan. And President Joe Biden stumps for Governor Gavin Newsom in California. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Hindsight is always 2020. Whether it's for us, whether it's for the previous administration or the ones before.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken testified about the U.S. ending the war in Afghanistan Monday before a House committee. Republicans harshly criticized the withdrawal, during which a bomb attack killed 13 and hundreds of Americans and Afghan allies were left behind. Lee Zeldin of New York called it a disgrace and a disaster.
And it is so greatly unfortunate, the consequences, and I believe that you, sir, should resign.
Blinken countered, if the U.S. waited any longer, the war would have escalated and lasted for many more years. He also repeatedly noted the White House was tied to an agreement President Donald Trump made with the Taliban.
We inherited a deadline. We did not inherit a plan.
Committee Chair Gregory Meeks said the panel will also hear from officials from the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations.
This is a war that should have ended 19 years ago with a different outcome. But our hubris, our own desire to remake Afghanistan, our own willingness to negotiate got in the way of that victory.
Today, Blinken testifies before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Flights of Afghan refugees into the U.S. will remain paused another 7 days after measles cases were detected among recent arrivals. The process could delay resettlement efforts by several weeks. The latest plan from House Democrats to fund a $3.5 trillion spending plan would raise the top corporate tax rate from 21 to 26.5% and includes a 3% surtax on people with adjusted gross income of more than $500,000. Also Monday, a bipartisan group of congressional leaders gathered on the Capitol steps to mark the 20th anniversary of 9/11.
When we visit the memories of September 11th, we tread on sacred ground.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on that day, the innocence of a generation was lost. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell noted Americans showed unity and resolve runs deeper than sadness.
Today, we solemnly remember the day we said, never again. Let us also remember what it takes to keep that promise.
Meanwhile, President Joe Biden took an aerial tour of three states hit by the wildfires and urged Congress to pass measures to fight climate change.
These fires are blinking code red for our nation. They're gaining frequency and ferocity, and we know what we have to do.
Biden later campaigned for California Governor Gavin Newsom, whose recall election is today. Associate political science professor at Cal State Fullerton, Sarah Hill.
Republicans in California feel so left out of the political process, and they're really frustrated and kind of didn't know what else to do or how else to raise a protest and be heard.
If the recall is a success, the new governor would finish Newsom's term and be up for re-election in 2022. Conservative talk show host Larry Elder is the Republican frontrunner. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
The Klamath Tribe in Oregon seeks to create a fire agency following the Bootleg Fire, and a Native community opposes South Dakota's social studies standards. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Klamath Tribe in Oregon wants to create its own fire agency following this year's Bootleg Fire, which burned much of their ancestral land. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
The Bootleg Fire consumed over 413,000 acres. One-fourth of that was Klamath Reservation land. Steve Rondo is the tribe's natural resources director. He says the Klamath hope to get funds soon to launch their own fire agency, which would work with other governmental agencies on wildfire management.
From a tribal perspective, fire is a process upon the landscape, and it's something that we have to live with. So looking back on our practices, we can see a future where our greater society can take lessons from the past and apply them to these current conditions, and we can change our environment for the better and prevent some of these mega fires from actually happening.
Rondo says there's growing receptiveness to tribal practices such as controlled burns, which have helped limit the size and growth of wildfires. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Native students, parents, and members of an Indigenous-led organization held a march for students Monday in Pierce, South Dakota. Members of the Native community, Indian Collective, and their allies are opposing South Dakota's newly proposed social studies standards, saying it perpetuates the erasure of Indigenous history and perspective. They say more than a dozen references of Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people of South Dakota and surrounding areas were taken out of the standards, and that the draft does not reflect the consensus worked on earlier this summer. Nick Tilson, CEO of Indian Collective, spoke at the event, which was streamed online.
This land and these schools, these land and these schools are our schools. These are the schools of the Osheti Shakoni. This is the land of the Osheti Shakoi. And no matter what decisions they make in the building behind us, it's always going to be our land. They tried to kill us. They tried to assimilate us. They tried to use education as a weapon. And now we're reclaiming that power. We're reclaiming that through our language. We're reclaiming that through our culture. And we're reclaiming that through our ceremonies. And so today is a proud day to be Lakota. It's a proud day to be part of the Osheti Shakoi.
Whose land?
Our land. Whose land?
Our land.
Whose schools?
Our
schools. Whose schools?
Our
schools. Hechetuala, Wopilatanka, Chichapala.
They're calling on the state to make inclusive the understandings of Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people in the standards and honor tribal consultation. A statement from the State Department of Education in August to the Sioux Falls Argus leader about the changes said certain adjustments were made to provide greater clarity and focus for educators and the public. A ski resort in California announced its new name Monday, dropping a derogatory term against Native American women. The formerly known Squaw Valley Ski Resort is now Palisades Tahoe. The name change comes more than a year after the resort announced it would be renamed, which included tribal consultation. The resort was founded in 1949, hosted the 1960 Winter Olympics, and is a popular destination. A two-minute YouTube video announces the name change. The Department of the Interior announced Tuesday it will begin consultation with tribes on protecting and restoring homelands. The Interior Department is focusing on the land into trust process, leasing and rights of way, and sacred site and treaty rights. Tribes are being invited to provide input. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
More than 1 million people in drought-stricken Madagascar face food shortages, and climate change could bring more frequent droughts. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In southern Madagascar, more than 1 million people urgently need food, and thousands face dire famine conditions. The region is normally hot and dry, but multiple years of severe drought have devastated harvests of maize, rice, and other staple crops on the African island. Massive dust storms and locusts have ravaged what few crops remain.
There's very little sign of water, and there's very little sign of vegetation as well.
Shelley Thackerell is with the World Food Program, which provides emergency food aid. In the hardest-hit communities, she's met people who've been forced to eat wild cactus leaves and tubers to survive. Rates of severe malnutrition have spiked, especially among children.
People living day in, day out, morning to night, every day, with empty stomachs.
As the climate warms, southern Madagascar is expected to grow even hotter, with more frequent droughts.
None of these people in the south have contributed to the climate crisis. They don't drive cars, they don't fly planes.
Yet she says the people of southern Madagascar are already suffering the impacts of climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 14th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Eric Galatis, Antonia Gonzalez, Sophia Mohammed, Josh Salem, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow, KBOO is kicking off our 2021 Fall Membership Drive with a News and Public Affairs Day commemorating the International Day of Democracy. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Rowland is joined by Jared Yates Sexton, author of American Rule: How a Nation Conquered the World but Failed Its People, to talk about democracy, anti-democracy, and American contradictions. At 9, it's Fight the Empire, connecting history with the latest world events. At 9:30, special programming for the International Day of Democracy. Reporter Melissa Hood is joined by Paxton Rothwell and Taylor Walker from the Portland hub of the Sunrise Movement to discuss why our country's legislators need to begin taking serious action in order to effectively inhibit climate change. At 10, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. Norm Diamond hosts this special program honoring the International Day of Democracy. Then at 11, it's the Food Show. Host Emily Becker talks to food system leaders about their work on policies to protect farm worker health, how the climate crisis is impacting water and farmers, and the rights of nature. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact.
I'm Monica Lopez. This week on Making Contact. September 11th, 2021 marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on the United States. In today's program, we turn our attention not to the tragedy of 9/11 itself, but to 9/11 as an inflection point in U.S. culture and policy in two areas: surveillance and homeland security, and the government and public regard of the use of torture in the war on terror. On this 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on the United States, Making Contact is speaking with leading thinkers and asking what 9/11's legacy has been in these areas. But first, we go to Making Contact producer Salima Hamarani. Using the backdrop of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the Department of Homeland Security began funding huge surveillance networks all over the country. They shared information between local and federal intelligence agencies, and they supposedly tracked information to prevent the next big attack on American soil. Or did they? Salima Hamarani brings us this story from Maine.
A lot of the surveillance infrastructure created after 9/11 remains part of everyday life in the United States. But activists might have a chance to dismantle at least one part of it. Fusion centers.
The Maine Fusion Center, as it's called, under scrutiny once again. Law enforcement leaders, though, argue that the program is critical for information sharing between departments, but critics say that their work is often an invasion of privacy.
The state of Maine is a current battleground where a bill introduced by Charlotte Warren seeks to defund its Fusion Center.
The Maine Information and Analysis Center was set up as part of a network of at least 78 fusion centers across the country in the wake of 9/11 as part of the government buildup in homeland security, domestic surveillance, international surveillance, as a way to share information between federal law enforcement agencies, intelligence agencies, and local police.
That's Matthew Gariglia, a policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
You know, after 9/11, there was a big political pressure to do something, right? And they added all new layers of institutional structure for security up and down the administrative hierarchy of the American state.
And that's Brendan McQuaid, author of a book on fusion centers and assistant professor of criminology at the University of Southern Maine.
The DHS fusion centers were created for counterterrorism after 9/11. But they quickly expanded to a nebulous all crimes, all hazards, all threats mission.
While the Fusion Center intelligence hubs have existed for 20 years, it's been difficult to know exactly what they've been doing in that time, even though journalists and policymakers have been asking questions. Here's Matthew.
Part of the problem with fusion centers, as in the problem with law enforcement and intelligence agencies at large, is that they are incredibly opaque. And when it's hard to understand what they're doing, it also means that they become hard to regulate.
But we now have some idea of what fusion centers do because of new information that's come to light.
And so what really happened with the Maine Fusion Center is a series of leaks, the Blue Leaks, a hack of, from what I understand it, a web hosting service that a lot of specifically law enforcement agencies use. and which were leaked to the public and dispersed through different media outlets who reported on some of the findings inside these documents.
And Brendan, intelligence gathering is kind of a vague term. What do we learn from blue leaks about the kind of data fusion centers actually aggregate?
Well, basically they aggregate everything and anything. They develop their own databases, but really what they do is remotely access other people's databases. So the first thing they want is all the government data. So I'm not just talking about the criminal legal system, although they do have access to that. But they want the records of the DMV. They want records from police departments about calls for service. They'll take demographic data from the census.
Fusion centers also aggregate information from social media via software and also through old-fashioned eavesdropping.
The actual human analysts will go through social media and monitor it for information.
And they have access to mountains of digital information flowing through cities.
So for example, the Crime Prevention Information Center, I believe it's called, the CPIC, which is the Metro Chicago Fusion Center, 20-some thousand security cameras all over the city of Chicago feed into that fusion center. Other fusion centers have automated license plate readers where the data goes directly to them. So they take all this data and they try to find the signal from the noise and find the patterns,
which DSA says they use to identify possible terrorist attacks like 9/11.
What happens in practice is something different. There really isn't that much terrorism. You know, there's not much terrorism. There's not much legitimate political violence for police investigators to look into. So what do they do in the absence of terrorism? You give police lots of new technology and resources, and they're going to put it to work doing the work that police do.
Brendan, what does that actually mean? Who's being targeted by fusion center spying since there's not actually a real terrorist threat in the United States?
The vast majority of fusion center surveillance is what they call situational awareness monitoring. So it's really at a distance, and it's mostly gathering information from social media. So the police will point to this and say, we're not doing surveillance. We're just letting people know that there's going to be this big disruptive protest and you have to redirect the traffic around it. That's the majority of fusion center surveillance. But then we have a series of other examples where fusion centers are mixed up in like much more traditional type political policing. So cases with informants and agent provocateurs and all that intrigue and cloak and dagger stuff.
In Maine, the fusion center seems particularly focused on the Black Lives Matter protests that erupted after the murder of George Floyd. Here's Matthew.
And specifically, they were funneling information to police that, for instance, stacks of bricks were being strategically placed, or that there were larger grand schemes for destruction already underway.
And this was a right-wing conspiracy theory. So a journalist here, Nathan Bernard with the Mainer, he dug into it. So he found out that there was a FBI document attached to all these Maine Fusion Center reports, an FBI document that supported, you know, that had further information about this claim about pre-staged bricks. The claim gets traced to an unconfirmed social media post from a pro-Trump biker who is associated with the group Super Happy Fun America, formerly Resist Marxism, that had organized straight pride parades in Boston and was basically a point of entry to the hardcore white supremacist movement, hardcore fascist right. And this got recycled by, you know, the Maine Fusion Center and blasted out to every cop in Maine, telling them, be careful, the anarchists are going to hurl bricks at you at the racial justice protests.
The blue leaks revealed that fusion centers were not very focused on, quote, terrorism threats from outside, but they were very preoccupied with internal threats from the left and with even more routine issues that plague most major cities.
And when you think about all the ridiculous police abuse all the viral clips we saw of very aggressive police behavior. The background of this is this constant hum, this constant churn of police documents coming out from fusion centers and other fusion center-like intelligence hubs, hyping up the threat of Black Lives Matter, of Antifa, of anarchist extremists, of eco-terrorists. And underneath that is even the even more routine drug users, homeless, untreated mental illness. These are all the enemies of order. So what do fusion centers do? They supercharge the war on drugs and the war on crime and the, you know, with high-tech surveillance. And they're like the connective tissue between the different pieces of the carceral state.
The Blue Leaks also highlighted the extremely close collaboration between the Department of Homeland Security and private money, which begins to muddy who the fusion centers target and why.
Aileen Brown at The Intercept has an excellent report about some fusion centers in the Midwest that were doing these like war game exercises about environmental eco-terrorism at the behest of energy companies. And say what you will about property destruction, but there's a strong argument to be made that so-called eco-terrorists shouldn't be considered political extremists. That debate is not happening, and we've built this huge apparatus to criminalize and go after people who are like militantly committed to the environment. And we've done that in partnership with the very capital interests that have a vested interest in burning every last drop of fossil fuels on this planet. This is what's happening with the Enbridge Line 3 right now in Minnesota. The fusion center is all over those protests. Same thing with the Mountain Valley Pipeline, another pipeline struggle where the fusion center is aggressively involved in working with the private sector to crush protests.
After Blue Leaks, pressure began to mount on the main fusion center and its problematic use of surveillance.
Maine Representative Charlotte Warren introduced an act to end the Maine Information Analysis Center program, which would defund the not very considerable but moderate amount of resources headed toward funding this fusion center and I believe its 12 employees and move it elsewhere where it might do more good and encourage more public safety. The bill, much to everybody's chagrin, passed the House and is still in process, from what I understand.
Fusion centers have become a target for the defund movement, which grew out of the George Floyd protests. And they may seem like a strange target for an organizing strategy focused on local police.
When we talk about policing and surveillance being out of control, we are also talking about fusion centers. We're talking about the Department of Homeland Security's ability to surveil Americans. We're talking about local police and all of the federal grants they get to buy surveillance equipment. So it really is a revolving door, and the boundaries between defunding local police and leaving maybe federal grants alone or federal law enforcement alone, those boundaries are definitely disappearing if they ever even existed.
The bill in Maine could set a precedent for what happens to fusion centers across the country, and other states are watching.
So after we did our bill in Maine, we've been contacted by activists and politicians in Massachusetts, in Wisconsin, in Texas, in Illinois, and whether or not they get a campaign together is kind of besides the point, because there will be future opportunities. There'll be future political opportunities that put the fusion center on the chopping block, that make it a political target. So I look forward to these future opportunities to close the Maine Information and Analysis Center, to close other fusion centers, to roll back mass surveillance and mass criminalization.
Matthew thinks that the fight against fusion centers is building off of a series of other surveillance fights in various cities as people begin to push back against the ever-increasing presence of government and big business spying into their lives since 9/11.
I think we've seen this in a lot of other cities and states with a lot of other technologies as well. I mean, just look at the movement that has been sweeping the country of states and cities banning face recognition or banning the use of predictive policing. But I think fusion centers are definitely going to be one of those next moves for civil liberties advocates, for racial justice advocates, for people who are interested in privacy. And already there are conversations about the, for instance, the Minneapolis Fusion Center, which I'm sure did its fair share of shuffling information from federal government to local police in regards to the protests that happened in Twin Cities. And so I think absolutely we're going to see a growing movement to defund fusion centers, because I think people are coming around to the knowledge that they might not be even that useful.
You were just listening to Matthew Gariglia from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Brendan McQuaid from the University of Southern Maine. For more information about fusion centers and the fight to end them, visit our website. I'm Salima Hamarani, reporting from Oakland.
Dr. Lisa Hajjar is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Her research focuses primarily on the U.S. war on terror, particularly around the issues of torture, targeted killing, and Guantanamo. Her forthcoming book is titled The War in Court, The Inside Story of the Fight Against Torture in the War on Terror. To date, she's traveled to Guantanamo 14 times in her research on military commissions. Dr. Hajjar spoke with me about the rise and fall of the post-9/11 torture program.
One of the very first decisions in the very immediate aftermath of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, President George W. Bush decided to make the CIA the tip of the spear, you know, for waging this war on terror, and authorized the CIA to engage in operations that came to be known as rendition, detention, and interrogation. So the CIA was presumably hunting for high-level terror suspects whom they would keep for themselves for their own interrogation purposes, which was separate from military interrogation and detention operations, first in Afghanistan and then on January 11, 2002, when Guantanamo became the primary facility for long-term interrogation and detention. I mean, of course, the CIA has a very long, robust history of torture as well as of lying and deceptiveness. And so that was one of the reasons why the CIA was so appealing as the kind of front agency, also because everything they do is completely classified. When the CIA captured its own first so-called high-value detainee, which the government uses the acronym HVD, who is a man whose nom de guerre is Abu Zubaydah. He was captured in Pakistan in March of 2002 and, you know, sort of spirited off to one of a succession of black sites or secret prisons. And, you know, the people who were authorized by the CIA to run their interrogation operations actually believed that the only way to get these high-value detainees, starting with Abu Zubaydah, to talk was to completely attack their psyches, to produce in them a condition that was called, you know, debility, disorientation, and dread. And so these, you know, contractors and other agents who were involved in the black site operations at the very start, you know, they sort of believed their own propaganda that we were unable to use regular interrogation tactics against them.
According to Professor Hajjar, this desire to use coercion and violence was coupled with an anxiety that what people were going to be doing to detainees at black sites could put them in hot water.
And so by the summer of 2002, you know, these radical right-wing lawyers who were in the inner circle around Vice President Dick Cheney, including John Yoo, who was a deputy assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Counsel. John Yoo wrote a memo which basically reinterpreted the laws pertaining to interrogation and detention in order to allow CIA agents to engage in torture and not fear future consequences. So it was essentially the way in which the government was seeking to, quote unquote, legalize torture. And that legal authorization was really foundational to the development of the torture program. It was written specifically for the CIA, which is a civilian agency and therefore not subject to the laws of war, particularly the Geneva Conventions. But it was passed by the White House to the Pentagon, and civilians in the highest echelons of the Pentagon then basically interpreted that green light for torture to also apply to military interrogations at Guantanamo and elsewhere. Early on, we're talking about like November and December of 2001, the word getting out to officers and soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan was, these people are not, you know, prisoners of war. The laws of war don't apply. Take the gloves off, you know, get the information you can. So many soldiers were engaging in brutality without any kind of legal cover. But it was really sort of once the CIA gets this governmental justification or legal cover, or what people have referred to as the golden shield, that the legal memos shielding them from consequences for what they were doing, it then spreads to the military and becomes part of military policy as well in the latter part of 2002 and then early into 2003. You know, right after President Bush issued his military order in November of 2001, decreeing that our enemies were unlawful enemy combatants and that they could be held incommunicado and subjected to trial by military commissions, one of the first people, you know, for whom this was like an alarming development was Michael Ratner, who was the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And he and his colleagues, you know, joined together with two death penalty lawyers, Joe Margulis and Clive Stafford Smith. They challenged the government's right to simply capture people and hold them without any access to lawyers, without any assessment of who they actually were or whether or not they were legitimately detained. And so that was the very first court case. It was named Rasul v. Bush. And so what happened was the case lost in the lower court, lost on appeal, but then to the shock and surprise of the Bush administration, the CCR lawyers and their allies beat the Bush administration when the Supreme Court ruled in Rasul v. Bush that the government cannot hold people indefinitely incommunicado.
Rasul v. Bush was one critical event in 2004 that moved the post-9/11 torture program closer to its end.
There were two other events, and you know, the one that perhaps is most well known to the more general public, at least of a certain age, was the Abu Ghraib scandal. After the United States invaded Iraq in March of 2003, you know, soldiers who were detaining people in Iraq had also been, you know, ordered to take the gloves off and you know, get intelligence about whoever was attacking U.S. and allied forces. And so there was also horrific violence in U.S.-controlled prisons in Iraq, including the Abu Ghraib prison. And so some of these soldiers who were working as military police took photos of themselves abusing detainees in absolutely horrifying ways. Some soldiers exchanged these photos among themselves. You know, ultimately, CBS ended up publishing the Abu Ghraib photos on April 28, 2004. Those Abu Ghraib photos created an absolute global scandal. So that was the first, that was a pivotal event, the beginning of the end of torture. It was finally Congress roused itself from its sleepy slumber to start asking questions about what was actually going on in detention facilities, you know, because everything was so classified and secret. this demand for, by Congress for more information led to the Bush administration releasing some legal memos and others being leaked to the media, including the infamous August 1, 2002 memo that John Yoo had written for the CIA. So while the Abu Ghraib photos were a global shocker, because the, you know, a picture says 1,000 words, for lawyers, the legal memos and the policy directives that became public as a result of the pressure caused by the Abu Ghraib scandal really angered and in some ways galvanized lawyers. And then several weeks later, the Supreme Court issued its ruling in Rasul v. Bush, basically opening Guantanamo to lawyers. And so it was that confluence of events that inspired hundreds of lawyers, like up to 600 lawyers and over 100 law firms over time, to sign up and volunteer to be habeas counsel for people detained at Guantanamo. What we could say is if the Abu Ghraib scandal and Rasul v. Bush were the beginning of the end of an active torture program occurs as a result of another set of events. You know, when the Bush administration decides to start prosecuting some Guantanamo detainees in these newly created military commission at Guantanamo, one of the first people who was charged was a guy named Salim Hamdan. You know, he was not some terrorist mastermind. He'd been basically, a driver for Osama bin Laden, but he was one of the first people to be prosecuted. And one thing that really shocked the hell out of the Bush administration and the Pentagon was the fact that military lawyers, JAGs, Judge Advocate Generals, the first ones who were assigned to defend people in the military commissions, basically put their legal ethics and their professional duties as lawyers above the orders to just, you know, plea bargain their clients. And so, you know, the first five defense lawyers all started fighting the Pentagon over, you know, not just the way in which their the people they were assigned to represent had been treated, but also the kind of ridiculous legal parameters for the military commission.
One of those lawyers was Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift. Hajar says he teamed up with a Georgetown law professor and attorneys from the law firm of Perkins Coie to sue Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld over the unconstitutionality of the military commissions.
And so that case was called Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. And again, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld loses in the lower court, loses on appeal. And then in June of 2006, in another, and what I would consider the most significant defeat for the Bush administration, and really what forces an end to the active torture program, was the Supreme Court's decision that not only were the military commissions that George Bush had created by presidential fiat with his, you know, November 2001 military order, was that unconstitutional, and therefore they wiped out the military commissions, but the more significant finding, the Bush administration had hoped that they could disregard the laws of war, the Geneva Conventions, because they were fighting non-state groups and therefore they didn't have to abide by the laws of war. Well, the Supreme Court in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld basically said common Article 3 of the 1949 Geneva Conventions, which is also regarded as the humanitarian baseline, applies to all people in U.S. custody overseas. And then the Supreme Court also reminded the government that violations of the Geneva Conventions are war crimes. For all intents and purposes, torture itself was kind of dry docked as a result of and after the Hamdan decision. And then when Barack Obama was elected president, one of his first acts in office was to definitively take the CIA out of the interrogation and detention business and categorically, you know, bring an end to the legality or the use of torture. There has not yet been a reckoning with our past. You know, now that we are approaching the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks themselves, that court case in the Guantanamo military commissions, which started under Bush, fell apart immediately, and then restarted under Obama, is continuing on. And it's not even at the trial phase, it's at the pretrial phase, because the U.S. government decided to torture people, and now it wants to prosecute people it tortured. And those two facts are irreconcilable. And so if you think about the 9/11 case as the one and only way in which all the 2,976 people who were direct casualties of the 9/11 attacks, if this case were to be the means of providing them justice, there has been no justice for them because the government tortured people, including those people it wants to prosecute for the 9/11 attacks.
Lisa Hajjar is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Her forthcoming book is titled The War in Court, The Inside Story of the Fight Against Torture in the War on Terror. The Making Contact team is Sonia Green, Anita Johnson, Salima Hamarani, Sabine Blazin, and I'm Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun. Living in the city where I'm working like a walrus, but man, I don't need your money, man. I'm gonna be an artist, and I'm feeling like I wanna do whatever I feel inside. Put it all on paper and I'll hope that people buy it. And my only minor worry is how to pay the rent. But that won't even
matter. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Camera activist Betty Lee has captured 30 years of street protests in Portland, from the 1989 demonstration condemning the racist murder of Mullah Gay Tahsirah to the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020. The Old Mole Variety Hour is pleased to offer a large print of your choice of Betty's most iconic photos to 10 lucky donors during KBOO's fall membership drive. Winners will be selected by lottery, and everyone who donates will be eligible. For more details and to see Betty's photos, go to kboo.fm/BETTELEE. Every Monday morning at 9 a.m., the Old Mole Variety Hour gnaws at the roots of our capitalist system with views, reviews, and interviews that you can sink your teeth into. Music by Lon.